Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Suraha Kenny. Each month, we ask a writer to select and read the work of another writer from the Stinging Fly's back catalogue. This month, Sarah Baum is our guest. Sarah was born in Lancashire and grew up in County Cork. She studied fine art and creative writing. Her fiction and criticism have been published in, among others, The Irish Times, The Guardian, The Stinging Fly and Granta magazine. Her debut novel, Spill, Simmer, Falter, Wither, was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award and longlisted for the Guardian First Book Award. At the time of this recording, Sarah is about to publish her second novel, A Line Made by Walking. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
What piece have you chosen for us?
I've chosen a story called Lay Down the Dark Layers by Deborah Rose Reeves.
And who is Deborah Rose Reeves?
I actually just looked at her bio and it's one of those deliciously short ones that just says Deborah Rose Reeves was raised in Dublin and now lives in Portland, Oregon. This is her first published story.
It's nice, isn't it? And there isn't that much, like we have such access to information now, but when I looked her up, I couldn't really find that much about her, which is kind of refreshing.
Yeah, she does have a blog and I think she's on Twitter, but she's someone who I actually spawned something of a friendship with in the aftermath of this story. But I've never met her in person. I know that she lives this kind of sort of very eclectic sort of hippie life in Oregon, and she has like goats and kittens and stuff like that. But I mean, I don't know her terribly well. It's funny how you make connections through people's work, but they remain sort of mysterious.
How much is writing a part of her daily life?
She has a day job, I think, quite a boring day job, and writing is a sideline. I think I've read other of her work, The Stinging Fly. This was her first published one, but they've published at least another one since. But I know she has other that she was working at one time on an account of a walk that she'd done through India. She's one of these very sort of exotic, well-traveled people who has yet to produce a published book, but I think is one to look out for, definitely.
Well, we'll chat a bit more about the piece itself, but for now I'll get you to read it, if that's okay.
Lay Down the Dark Layers by Deborah Rose Reeves. Claret. The piece is perhaps a landscape, certainly not a portrait or that of a figure, but briefly she imagines she has happened across a corpse in the bathtub, not a painting. Specks of crimson and claret spatter the white enamel, in which an easel looms, its subject flayed and seeping russet, red ochre, raw umber, burnt umber. She runs the tap until it steams, then rubs between her legs with a rough cloth. There is no soap, only a clutter of brushes in a can of turpentine. She cleans her teeth with her finger and stares into the mirror. Her mouth is still plumb from the wine they drank. I am a landscape too, she thinks, scratching at the crests and valley of her top lip. Insects and grass. Scrabbling for her shoes in the gloom, she casts short glances at the man asleep in the bed. She'd known him to see. The rest of the details were dim, only his hand on her thigh and the winking lights of College Green as the taxi rounded onto Pier Street and tore through the night towards the Docklands. She had not been this downriver since her father had brought her and her brother to see the tall ships passing through. She couldn't believe that people lived here now, was bewitched by the reflection of the water on so many new windows, and once inside the apartment, she held her head so she could see the silvery stillness the entire time she was there, until she was walking out the door again. Outside, she began to run, looking this way and that for a roaming taxi to take her back into the city or home. There was no urgency. She had no place to be. But she liked the image and how she believed she must look to anyone who might see her. Glassy-eyed, sparkle-dressed. A girl running wild in the pre-dawn. Crossing onto Lower Mount Street, She was still mid-flight by the copper fur of a fox beneath a streetlight, its green eyes regarding her from amid a litter of peelings and scraps. She had heard of urban foxes, of the den by the Doyle, how they scavenged for whatever they could get and would eat insects and grass if nothing else were available. But she had never seen one in real life. What happened to you anyway? In the morning she looked into the mirror and the face of a girl stared back and winced when she saw what she had not felt. Her fingertips rose to her cheekbone, beguiled. Her eye was a perfect plum, with streaks of black mascara and specks of fine glitter that she washed away. Then, pressing nearer to the glass and considering it more closely, she took in the pretty print of fuchsia, mustard, grass, and periwinkle. Last night's clothes lay scattered all around. In the kitchen, her flatmate regarded her from behind a cigarette and a French press. "I see you got home okay then," she said. "I couldn't find you. When I got back from the toilets, you weren't on the dance floor." "I must have been off looking for you," she said, stubbing out the half-smoked butt. "That's so weird. I looked all around. I'd got a drink for you." "So you went to the bar, or you went to the dance floor?" "Jesus, I don't know. God." They sat in silence with coffee and an ashtray between them, picking at their little bowls of plain yogurt and fruit. "What happened to you anyway?" asked her flatmate, finally. "Oh, this," she said. "I'm not really sure." At work, the women in the break room gathered around her. "Let's just say there was a headboard involved," she said, and they all whispered Jesus through their teeth. "Does he have a brother?" said Margaret, who was like a mother to them, or a father, and they cried laughing, then went back to their desks and thought the day would never come to an end. "Don't tell Mam," she said to her sister on the phone. "I can't believe he gave you a black eye," said her sister. "Who is this person?" "That's the thing," she said, touching her fingers to her face again. She was tired, and the night before seemed long ago. "It's everything but black. It's all these other colours." Portrait. Barmen called him by his name and knew what he wanted to drink. He paid for his first drink only, but was never without a glass before him. He was not ashamed for a woman to ask what he was having, and he stood unconcerned in the face of a round. It was the rare man who interrupted when he was speaking. Often a girl would grab her coat and leave in a hurry, while others would linger until just after he'd left, pretending not to notice him from evening until closing. He was despised by many, but repudiated by no one. There is a man like this in every pub and corner of the country. "And the thing is," she'd say to people, "I hadn't even thought about him that much." Though she wasn't in the habit of them, she was very understanding about one-night stands. Things happened. They didn't mean anything. Sometime later, though, she had popped into Hogan's after work and caught his eye at the other end of the bar. Dublin is a small town. She offered what she thought was a knowing but mollifying smile and expected that to be the end of it, in that she expected him to offer her something similar in return. Rather, he looked at her as though to say, "The fuck you looking at me for?" And the question opened what had been closed, revealing a space that a part of her rushed to inhabit. And this left its own space, and that, too, generated a void. And this accounted for the shame and longing that emptied and filled her as she waited to pay for her drink, and the thirst with which she drank it, and the apparent nonchalance with which she ordered another. And later, during a chance meeting on the stairs in which words were exchanged, she was so relieved by what she now assumed had been her own misunderstanding that she did not object to him pulling her into the ladies' bathroom and pressing her up against the wall. I'm on my way. Pale blossoms followed the bright berries of winter and fell away too soon. The shimmering mirage of summer, diaphanous rain. The days and months moved on, and she imagined she moved in pace with them. But here we see her in September. A barman is calling last orders, please, and she is saying goodnight to friends and waiting for a message that asks, is she around? She is. She is always around. Or can be. She is in the same place, the place that answers, I'm on my way. It is the same night as the first night, the same night as the last. 101 nights. The light and the breeze and the blossoms bend around her as they press on. Their situation. She enjoyed the sensation of stepping into a museum or gallery, parquet floors announcing her arrival and passage from room to room, where high ceilings amplified all things, from the tickle in her throat to the timid stirrings of her soul. It was a small joy, available to anyone, and costing nothing, which was perhaps why they were so often very empty, and she herself had only thought to pay a visit once she started sleeping with the painter on a regular basis. Sleeping with an artist was different than she thought. She had pictured so many sketches of herself, scattered in a light-filled place, reading a book, stepping into a bathtub, removing an earring, seated, standing. She imagined what it would be like to pose for him. Saw him lean in to fix a falling hair, moving her this way and that, though she supposed he did in his own way. Still, she hoped they might sometimes do other things together too, but she didn't know how to invite him to join her without giving the wrong impression. She wanted it to be clear that she understood their situation. So she would only sometimes mention that she was thinking of going to such and such an exhibition, and she would never say that she had been unless to say that she had been there with a friend, so that he wouldn't think of her as someone who was often alone. Sometimes she thought of herself alone in those long, tall rooms, her face raised to the rows of gilded frames, and it was beautiful. She liked this unexpected life. Her eye fell upon new shelves in bookshops, and she sought out others in the library. She began to acquire a new vocabulary and a way of seeing things, yet this, too, presented a problem. Having finally found something she might say to him, she found she could not say it. A sudden allusion to Caravaggio might strike him as peculiar. Pentimenti is an awkward word to work into a sentence when somebody has an idea of who you are already. 3 a.m. Whatever happened to your painting? She asked into the dark. Why? He said, after a few seconds. I was just thinking about it, she said. It's late, he said. A few minutes later he sighed, turned on the lamp, and left the room. When he came back with the canvas under his arm, she sat up and clapped, and he shook his head. He climbed back into bed and set it between them. It had not changed much since the first time she had seen it. Her fingers hovered over it. Don't touch, he said. I know, she said, though she did want to place her hands on it and feel the thin scratches and depressions that textured the surface. Several times, she could see, he had painted a layer, then waited for it to dry before taking to it with something rough. In a few trace places, he had scratched through the deep browns and iron reds to reveal the canvas beneath. Dark mottling suggested rocks in a fallow field, but it was not discernibly of anything. She looked at him and smiled through sudden tears. "Is it finished?" she said. "No," he said. He picked up the painting and set it on the floor. "First you lay down the dark layers, and then you add light. It can take a while." He switched off the lamp and turned away. Her eyes adjusted again to the gloom. "Hey," she said. "What?" he said. "Thank you." Her sister said, "What happened to his teeth?" And she said, "What do you mean?" "He's missing two of his teeth," she said. She tongued her top and bottom teeth, counting and thinking. "It's like this one and this one," she said, placing the curled tip of her tongue on one tooth and another. "I don't know," she said. "I never noticed it." She said she would look the next time she saw him, but the next time she saw him, she forgot to look. Her old dear friend. Her old dear friend set his glass on the table and kicked at the legs of the stool she was sitting on, across from him. "What the fuck?" she laughed, but his eyes did not return her smile. "You're always looking over my shoulder," he said. "What?" "When we're out, when I'm talking, you're always looking just past me." "No, I'm not," she said. "Am I?" "He's not even here," said her friend, and picked up his drink and looked away. They sat like that for what seemed like a long time, looking around the room and into their drinks. Finally, she kicked at the legs of his stool and made a sad face to see if he would smile. Patronage. For a third week, the rain was preventing him from working. For money, he painted houses, and nobody had their doors or windows done in this weather. "Fucking rain," he said. What could he do? She asked him about the insides, or other odd jobs, bar work, maybe. "Sure nobody's the money to be painting their kitchens every 5 minutes anymore," he said, taking a long drag from a joint and passing it to her. "They're stuck with their fucking persimmon now, aren't they?" She supposed so. "Come here to me," he said. In the morning, before she left for work herself, she set 2 tens between the tea bags and the sugar. She thought to leave more, but this way he might think it was his own that he'd forgotten. Either way, he never mentioned anything about it. A couple of weeks later, he was shy of his rent. "It's not like he asked me for it," she thought, licking the envelope. "He was just talking and I was just there." "Thank you, thank you, thank you," he said. She spoke to her father, whose mother's house was sitting idle. It might sell quicker if they had a bit of work done. She had a friend who could start right away. She thought of him in his paint-spattered overalls in her nana's old kitchen, listening to the small portable radio, milky tea pouring from the teapot, so familiar. Her sister sent a message when she was at work. Dad was going mad. Globs of paint and plaster were ground into the floor. The sink was clogged with the stuff. There were dirty dishes on the counter, brushes and rollers stuck to trays of dried paint. "He's not going to pay for this crap," said her sister. "I've already paid him," she wrote back. "I'm on my way." She called him from the taxi and tried to explain things from her father's point of view, how it was his mother's house and what that meant to him, so it was hard to see the place just left that way. He said he was sorry. He planned to go back and clean it up, but had just got a call about another job and couldn't turn it down. "You know what it's been like," he said. "What could he have done?" Her father and sister had cleaned the house and gone by the time she got there. She let herself in and stood in the small kitchen, transformed completely from her memory of it. The windows were bare of their faded net curtains. The grimy wallpaper had been stripped spare. He'd filled in the parts in the walls that had crumbled, painted them a delicate color she would never have thought of. It was brighter and more open, as she'd hoped. It was good work. On Georgia Street, an encounter. She wandered into Dunn's and placed in the basket the makings of a meal. Stewing beef, onions, carrots, russets, crusty bread and butter, wine. She tried to picture his kitchen, what might or might not be in it, but could only see her hand around a glass and the cold tap running in the middle of the night. She picked up a box of salt and considered it, then replaced it on the shelf and walked away. She returned the wine and chose a different bottle, then went back for the salt and noticed, on the way, a large pot on sale that got her thinking about utensils. Standing in the checkout line, she composed a text, but was called to pay before she could send it. Out on the street, she fumbled with her bags and phone when he appeared through the arch of the old shopping arcade and down towards her. A girl was walking with him. He touched her hip and steered her across the traffic to the other side of the road. On the bus home, she looked down at her boots, surrounded by paper bags filled with dresses and books and thank you cards and chocolate and something for her sister and all of the food for dinner and the big pot. And she felt a little sick from the fumes that come from the engine under the back seat, but it is also warmest there, and it was the beginning of winter. Salt. An uncommon snow fell in November, softening steeples and iron railings, pillowing cobblestones and filling the cracks. Low clouds leached into rooftops, grey as the gulls that screeched from deep within them. Displaced. They skittered on the air, wanting to settle but wary and resentful. The intricate expanse of streets and alleys was from afar a frozen lake, sighs and speculations echoing from its fissures. People walked as though for the first time, hands stretched to steady them, ready to slide. Delighted at first, strangers smiled at each other in mutual commiseration. They laughed nervously or were quieted with wonder. The air was still and time appeared to stop, but when life continued to make demands of them, they became impatient and anxious for salt to arrive from Europe. They soon remembered the last year's unexpected cold snap. "You'd think we'd have learned something," they said. "Desideratum, from desire," she murmured beneath her breath, her fingers following the small font across and down the soft, translucent page of an aged dictionary. From the old French, desirer, wish for, long for. From Latin, desirarer, long for, wish for, but also meaning demand, expect. Her eyes hovered over the words, then continued down the page. Original sense was perhaps, await what the stars will bring, from the phrase, de zird air, from the stars, from Cetus, star, constellation, heavenly body. She set aside the heavy tome, and scanned the article she'd been reading. She couldn't remember the sentence she'd paused upon. her reason for needing the dictionary in the first place. Distracted, she couldn't say how she'd got from there to here, not in so many words. When she left the reading room, the clock in the front square struck the quarter hour. It was hardly past six, but so dark as to seem deep night. It was strange to see that the day was not nearly done, that she had more time than she thought. She walked across the cobblestones, illuminated by the lamps in the arches of the college chapel and the campanile. She had not a single idea but that Dublin was loitering beyond the gates, waiting for her. Passing through the wooden entrance of the west door, she ignored the notice boards overflowing with events, flyers, and the invitations to various clubs and societies, and stepped out into the city and nowhere in particular. The coach and ferry. There was nothing to be done. He would have to go to London. His flatmate had asked him to leave, a rancorous end to what had been a friendship. Sides had been taken in Grogan's and the cobblestone. He owed everybody something. Twice he had moved back home, but he couldn't be himself. They knew him too well. Where else can I go? You could stay with me, but you know what my flatmate's like, she lied. She took him out to dinner, and, later, lay in the crook of his arm, face pressed to his bony ribcage, rising and falling to the dull rhythms within, lulled to sleep by a long list of betrayals that thankfully didn't include her. She did not know where he spent his last days and nights in Dublin. She had given him some little things for fun, but they seemed foolish now when she thought of him on the coach and ferry. A string bag of chocolate coins in golden foil, and a small box of paints, and a set of postcard-sized watercolour paper. She wrote her name and address on the first one, and asked him to send her a little painting from somewhere better. When the postman came, and there was nothing for her, she was relieved to have been so soon forgotten. I am here for you. She was the kind of girl that people unburdened themselves to whilst waiting for a bus. She found it difficult to extricate herself from the recounting of a grievance, and often she settled into her seat, accepting that she was here till the end of the line with this one. She became frightened of being old. Women shared more resentments, and men tended towards regret, though not remorse. One night, a man stumbled up to her and asked if this was the stop to Rathmines. He thought he was staying at a travel lodge there. He didn't need to tell her he was on a stag weekend from England. A short-sleeved shirt on a winter night said it all, and she hoped he would wander away again, but he leaned against the wall beside her. It was a rare night out for him, he said, and she smiled politely but looked away, waiting for the bit about the ball and chain. He was a night watchman at a hospital, he continued, and she commiserated about the strange hours, surrendering to being sucked into his life for a while. The hours were strange, he agreed, but he had chosen them. He was avoiding his family, he told her, a lovely wife and a daughter. He loved them in his head, he said. He knew he did, but he felt nothing, nothing. Not even when the girl was a child. He knocked back a couple of cans every morning when he got home and slept into the evening. He didn't know what else to do. She didn't know what to tell him. When the bus came, he preferred to stand, but he looked her way every few minutes until she nodded that this was his stop. He looked in through the window as the bus pulled away, as though to say, now what? She pointed straight ahead, on your left, and watched him follow her finger up the street of a place he didn't come from. Midwinter. She wakes in the dark and lays there. A thin light flits and shrinks below her door as her flatmate makes her way to and from the bathroom. Outside, the suburbs groan but rise, obedient. Taxi lights blink on and off, a new day for some, winding down for others who see bright yolks spitting in the pan and mopped up with bread before bed or second jobs. In town, the streets are dark, still but expectant. Lights beneath bridges bleed into the river, the clinking chorus of steel kegs on the cobblestones. And far beyond the city, in a country field, a single ray of light slips between a crack, creeps a darkened passageway, and is greeted in a tomb by reverent gasps. Her feet are on the floor now, but the rest of her is slow to follow. Where is there to go? Without standing, she bends forward and draws the heavy drapes. The white wall flutters and sways with leaf shadows, and the lighter shadows of the spaces between leaves, like some pacing, piebald creature. She reaches out to pet it, and it has gone. Lute player. There are two versions of the lute player by Caravaggio. One is in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. The other is part of the Wildenstein collection in New York City. In both versions, what looks like a child, doe-eyed, pink lips slightly parted, thin fingers strumming on the strings. On one of them, some fragments from a madrigal on the lute player's sheet music say, Vos sapet chivo vamo, vostra fui. You know I love you, I was yours. The other does not. Horizons. He was not long coming back on the boat. He called her. Poles had got there first, he said. Better the shambles, you know. London is a joke. He hung up and texted her the address of the place he was staying. She stared up at the steel door, its rusting hinges and bolts, a standard delinquent scrawl, and a keyhole where the handle might ordinarily be. Shivering in the grey light, waiting for him to come down and let her in, she saw that she had not broken any of the habits she thought she had. They had only, briefly, been impractical to keep. Two men crossed the road and whistled through their fingers at another up the street. She held her handbag tight. She stood her ground as they sauntered on by. Dark stairs led to a small flat. In the hallway, his painting rested against a wall with a couple of black bin bags, a pair of work boots, and a bicycle frame. She thought to say something, but his head was already bent low and away from her, focused on his tins and rolling papers. The painting had changed since she'd last seen it. He had introduced a middle ground with a distant mountain range, folds of auburn and vermilion shadows. Above them, clouds hovered low in a pumpkin sky, soft, curved strokes of cornflower, rose, pale lilac, lavender. If the intent had been to add depth, the effect had fallen flat. The original dark foreground dominated the eye, the bright sky imparting not perspective or a counterpoint to the darkness, but seeming torn from another painting altogether. Come here, he said. She turned towards him and saw the painting sitting in the hallways of many places to come. I read that Degas practiced cloud formations with a crumpled hanky held up against a lamp. She said. Just come here, he said. He was stretched out on a low windowsill, smoking. In the street below, a kid balanced a football on his knee, and an older youth restrained a pit bull. He offered her the dregs of the joint he was smoking. "I have to go back to work soon." "Suit yourself," he said, and looked away down at the boys and the ball and the road and the dog. He rested his hand on her thigh, and she let him, so he moved it in between her legs and rubbed at her jeans with his thumb. "Don't," she said. He arched his hips and pulled his pants down around his thighs. "I have to be back at work soon. Please." "I can't." "Then what the fuck are you here for, then?" A light in the darkness. They come every year, the last days of January, tall ships passing through. So much that was sworn has already been forgotten, so much that was promised abandoned. Still, there is a chance again, at least, to wander on up to Merrion Square and take a look at Turner's watercolours, stroll through the park and make a day of it. The paintings were known as a light in the darkness, and she thought of them that way, though she had never seen them. She thought of them trembling gold in their dark cabinet the year long, their whispers building to delirious song, pining for that month when light is at its lowest and they would be released. She approached them as a bright assurance, the room aglow with glass and spotlights. She had been waiting for this day too. The shipwrecks then, the looming cliff faces, grey-green squalls and blue coldness of so many scenes struck her as bleak, and she moved through these paintings quickly, seeking the warm sunsets and rises of her expectations. She liked those landscapes that were mere suggestions of a thing and not too much the thing itself. She did not want detail or reality. She only wished to dissolve into the faint washes of peach and rose reflected in still waters. Soon, she had completed a circle of the room and seen everything she had come to see, glanced over the rest. It had not taken very long. She looked around to see what other people were looking at and lingering on, wondering what they were seeing that she had failed to appreciate. She did not want to leave yet, to go back out there. "Is this it?" she asked, sinking and rising on the answer.
Sarah, we're just going to have a conversation about Deborah Rose Reeve's story now. And I was going to start off by saying, it reminded me initially of your work a little bit, in particular because of Seasons, I thought, on reading it first. But then I kind of realised it's perpetually winter in the story, really, isn't it?
No.
It runs through, because I just kept going, oh, I have got it right, there's seasons. But then winter seems to be
The pervasive season. No, yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, one of the reasons I think I chose it is because when I first read it, it was one of those, oh, no. Not that I suppose one always kind of goes, oh, that's a brilliant story. I wish I'd written it. But, well, I don't always do that. But sometimes with stories that they just seem aligned with your sensibility, or it seems like a story that you could have written. And this was so close to that that it affected me more than other brilliant stories. But it's not. And The Seasons was definitely something that I think that I really love about it. And there's summer. It kind of goes from summer through to the change into winter.
What else about this story? What drew you to it? What made you pick it?
I think it's really beautifully written. It's really beautifully put together, more than anything. And it's very little happens, but it has this wonderful, gentle kind of movement. And there are little clues sort of dropped that tie up very nicely. So it has by no means a beginning, middle and end, but everything that's in there makes sense to the themes. Like, for example, at the beginning, she just mentions the tall ships. that her father brings her and her brother to see. And then, I was thinking about this, and I think of it as a story in the voice of the narrator, of the girl.
Yeah.
Because it's actually third person. It's third person subjective, but it's so convincing that I keep thinking of it as the narrator.
As first person.
There's the tall ships, and then that builds up to the final scene, or the final little snippet, in which she's talking about the Turner paintings and the tall ships. The tall ships come back again in some way, and there's lots of things like color is a big thing that sort of penetrates through. It begins with the colors in the painting, but then there's the colors of the bruise on her face, and you know the colors of her grandmother's kitchen, and it just had a really it just there were certain threads going through it that continued on through. But it's also a really lovely, really sort of sweetly told story of just someone getting fucked over.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, because at no point, like, you feel like she's getting a bit of strength, and she says herself, even she thought she'd kind of learned by her mistakes, but then she just seems to. Is she in love with the artist, do you think?
Well, it's funny because there's this kind of like pseudo nonchalance as well. You know, it's like she kind of knows that he's messing her around, but she. And she's kind of acting, she doesn't even know that she's quite so infatuated as she is, I think. And yet, you know, it appealed to me as well, because I totally understand that sort of strange allure of the artistic type, you know, for better or worse. And, you know, she knows, the character knows that she's being carried along in some way, but there's a lovely bit, there's kind of a moment of revelation at the end when she sees the painting. I think the painting is just this brilliant object that kind of carries the whole thing. And then towards the end, when he comes back from London and she visits him, and the painting is leaning against the wall with a bicycle frame, and she suddenly has a vision of like the painting being carried around with him, and you know, perhaps kind of realizes that he's not even much of an artist.
Yeah.
He just has this one painting.
Yeah.
And this is when she finally says no to him, kind of thing, and it comes to a head.
And the paintings that like are dotted throughout the story, then, as you say, the Caravaggio and the Turner, that also reminded me of you in a way, because your background is in visual art, but you've also written about visual art.
Yeah.
Why do you think she picked those two in particular, those two artists, those massive artists, Caravaggio and Turner?
And yeah, well, I think Caravaggio because of the light, surely, because light is such a big thing in the story. And then the Turner as well, the because she goes to the gallery at the end and expects this sort of the light to come through in these paintings that are only being exposed to the light in January, and then sort of fails to find what the fuss was about in a way, or finds it hard to see the light. I could be interpreting it completely incorrectly now, but that's what I saw about it. And then Caravaggio, of course, is so well known for his shadows. And there's also, well, there's a mention of Degas, but it's the anecdote that she tries to impress the artist with at the end is how he uses a crumpled handkerchief in a lamp to create cloud formation. But yeah, that was definitely something. I mean, art is a big thing, you know, in my own life and my interests. So that was something else that came across in the story. But I thought it was nicely done, because the girl is not someone who is an artist. It kind of exposes his, as I say, the allure of like the exotic artist, and she's actually the much more interesting character of the two, you know. So I thought it was used very well, not in a cheesy way or
no. But do you think she's also trying to find solace in it, in this world of art, as an alternative way of finding solace instead of these one night stands and these?
Yeah, which is in another way, she has a reason to be grateful for this guy who fucked her over, because she starts going to art galleries and she starts looking in books and seeing the world slightly differently. So it's cleverly done.
I don't know if you'd agree with me, but I just get this overwhelming sense of loneliness from the entire thing. Just on hearing you read it again, that's like my second time hearing it today.
I irresistibly sort of had a wistfulness in my voice, I think, all the way through, and I didn't realise it until towards the end. But I think that's the mood. And like you were saying before, that it feels like it's winter all the way through, even though it isn't. But there's that kind of a, a gloom that hangs over. And for me, like, I'm furiously interested in that kind of quarter life crisis thing, that, you know, the lonely student, young people are supposed to be so full of life and have everything, and yet increasingly there's a stage at which one is lost, the stage perhaps at which you realize how much you actually don't know, as opposed to thinking that you're great and you know everything, you know. So yeah, I think that was very convincing in terms of a young person finding themselves.
And it's clear, certainly, like, you introduce them all, but there are, it's divided into these sections throughout the story. So why do you think she's done it that way? What do you think that's about?
Well, they're like tiny chapters, and it could easily have been a novel. And I think the fragments, the time span it takes place across is sort of fragmented. I think there's supposed to be this sort of sense that, you know, he's this man that sort of exists in her life, but not consistently in any way. I think the way they connect is kind of interesting. Like, there's a whole one about, well, there's a random one about her sister mentions his teeth, but then there's one about how she's the kind of girl who people unburden themselves to on at bus stops. And then there's this story of a drunk man who tells her about how he's a night watchman and he doesn't really love his wife and he can't feel things and he just drinks a few cans. And, you know, one might kind of go, well, what the fuck has that got to do with the rest of the story? But it's nicely placed, and there's other ones that kind of play the same role, because it's just sort of about love and lovelessness and despair, and that completely relates to all of the themes of the story, even though in another, looking at it another way, it's, you know, it's oblique. So I think they work in a clever way. They make you stop and consider why a small fragment was there, how it relates to the whole.
And that seems like a nice place to leave it for now. That's it for the second episode of the Stinging Fly podcast. My thanks to our guest Sarah Baum, who read Lay Down the Dark Lairs by Deborah Rose Reeves from issue 29, volume 2 of The Stinging Fly. My name is Sarah Kenny, and I'll be back with you again next month for another episode of this podcast.